This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Many of us dread airline trips, not because we're afraid of flying, but because flying can be so miserably uncomfortable. As my guest James Fallows puts it, modern airline travel has become an inefficient hell. His new book, Free Flight, is about an emerging solution, the use of new high-tech small jets, which would operate like air taxis. He'll explain in a minute. Fallows is the Atlantic Monthly's national correspondent. His article, Freedom of the Skies, is this month's cover story. Fallows is a former commentator on Morning Edition. He says that missed connections and overnight delays have helped create our current airline hell, but as bad as the problems of air travel are when things go wrong, the most impressive thing is how unpleasant and wasteful the experience can be when nothing has gone wrong.
Well, let's start from the beginning. Suppose you know you want to go visit your relatives or go to a convention. You have to start thinking about this 4 to 6 weeks in advance if you don't want to be scalped on the actual price of the ticket, since it's become so prohibitively expensive to be flexible in your travel. So you're worrying about it in the back of your mind for a long time. As the day itself approaches, you think, oh, how am I going to get there? Am I going to call the super shuttle and be there 2 hours ahead of time? Am I going to try to find a place to park? Am I going to worry? How is the congestion going to be? Am I going to get through the tunnel? Am I going to get through the bridge? And since there are all these stations of the cross you must go through, are you going to drive or take the shuttle? What's the congestion going to be like? How are you going to get to the terminal itself? What's the check-in line going to be like? What's the security line going to be like? What about the little shuttles going to the other terminals? What other things can go wrong there? You have 6 or 8 things, any one of which can have these, quote, unexpected, unquote, difficulties. And if you allow for the worst case with all of them, you find yourself doing what I actually complained about years ago when I was living in Japan, which is having to leave for the airport 4 hours ahead of time. So I needn't elaborate, because all too many of the listening public knows this in their bones.
The airline system now is a hub system where if you're going to any place other than like a major city, you have to have a stopover someplace else first. How has the hub system changed air travel?
You know, this is the actual heart of what's happened with airlines in the last 20 years. So it's worth hammering home its basic point. In the olden days before deregulation 20 years ago, the airlines had a lot of routes like nonstop, you know, New York to Little Rock, or nonstop Portland, Oregon to San Antonio, or so a bunch of oddball routings. And they only had one or two a day, so they were inconvenient in that way. And they were relatively more expensive than what's been the case now. But when 20 years ago airlines were allowed to compete on price, they found, number one, that for all of our complaints, we actually do value cheap tickets, we, the buying public, more than anything else. So they found that they had to keep the price as low as they could. Next, they found that to keep the price low, they had to keep these big planes full, as you may have noticed they are. And number three, to keep them full, they couldn't go nonstop Little Rock to New York, because not enough people wanted to do that. But if they went from New York to then Chicago, and then smaller planes branching off from Chicago to Little Rock and Dubuque and wherever else, it was more efficient for them. They kept the planes full, and the prices were lower. And the problem was for the passenger, because year by year, the actual door-to-door travel time got slower because of the congestion of forcing everybody through, you know, O'Hare, Denver, DFW, Charlotte, the main hub airports.
And another problem, as you point out, is if there's weather problems in one part of the country, it can affect air travel in the opposite end of the country, because everything's so interconnected through this hub system.
And it's to compound that, you have a couple of the hubs in some of the least desirable weather places in our great United States. You know, Chicago, bad in the winter, bad with thunderstorms in the summer. Denver, sudden. I was once trying to get from Seattle to Atlanta, and a sudden April snowstorm in Denver kept me from getting there. And you wonder, why exactly does weather in Denver affect me when I'm going from Seattle to Atlanta? But of course, In the miracle of the hub system, it does. DFW has thunderstorms, et cetera. And so it's the opposite of almost everything else we've done in technology in the last 20 years. The model would be as if there were only one ATM site per city, and everybody who wanted money in New York had to go down to 14th Street and get their money out of that one thing. We have ATMs every place. It's really only in the airline system you have this very, very centralized kind of command and control thing, where if there's a jam at one point, again, Denver, San Francisco with fog, Chicago with storms, the ripple effects are all over the place.
The FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, has come up with a 10-year, $11 billion plan to modernize the air travel system. What are the highlights of this plan?
The main thing the FAA is going to do is to apply a lot of things that are in sort of operational tests now to get rid of some of the real obvious problems of how the system now works. And I'll give you, I think, the clearest example. When an airline is planning a trip from New York to San Francisco, they naturally use the whole continental map of the U.S. and draw their routing. But suppose along the way there is a big thunderstorm. Thunderstorms are really the only thing that an airplane can't go over. Thunderstorms go so high that airplanes have to go around them. There's a thunderstorm in the Midwest, and the airplane has to deviate. You would think it would be relatively easy, and it would be by computers, just to route all the planes around the thunderstorms. But the way the FAA works now, each controller owns a little part of airspace, and it's a real harassment for the person in Indianapolis Center to coordinate with the one in Minneapolis Center to get all the planes routed one way or another. So they can do a lot of automatic routing things. Better weather information, more runways at a couple of the largest airports, ways safely to let planes fly more closely together than they do now with no compromise of safety. So all these things are good as far as they go. The question is, how far they go.
Well, you don't think they go far enough.
Well, even the FAA, for which I have, as a pilot whose license is always up for inspection by the FAA, I'm quick not to criticize them. But it's true that even they said in releasing this report, they thought it might add 30% to the total system capacity by 2010. The same FAA report said that by 2010, demand for air travel was expected about double. If everything in the FAA plan comes through exactly as foreseen, you'll have a worse situation 9 years from now than you do now.
And why would it be worse?
It would be worse because they're planning to increase capacity by 30%. They think demand for traffic will rise by, up to 100% in that same time. So you'd be trying to get more stuff through the same slightly larger pipes than you have now. And it could be that this demand will not be realized. They'll find some way to shed it off to, by raising prices. But even they think this won't keep up with the foreseen demand for air travel.
My guest is James Fallows. His new book is called Free Flight: From Airline Hell to a New Age of Travel. In your new book, you talk about a new system for airline travel that's just in the early developmental phase now. It's based around small jets that would be like air taxis. Give us the big picture before we talk about the details.
The big picture here, I think, is best analogized to the workings of the internet, where you have, I think, as people know, if you send things from your computer to my computer, each little packet of information might take a whole variety of different pathways till it gets to its destination. And the idea is dispersing things rather than congesting them. The way this would apply in the big picture form to the air system is that we now have about 70% of all traffic going through 31 airports in the country, probably the 31 you could name and have visited as hubs in the last couple of years, whereas there are many thousands of airports already built in the country that are very little used, that are big enough for all but the hugest planes. So the idea is to spread more of the traffic to these small airports that are close to where people actually live, that are not congested, and so allow for a shunting away of this pressure of congestion that's made things so unpleasant and so slow in the normal airline system.
And these are the airports that are primarily used now for private planes.
Yes, they're primarily used now for two kinds of planes. One is little so-called GA or general aviation planes, little propeller planes, Cessnas, Bonanzas or whatever. The other is corporate jets.
Now, what about the safety? A lot of small plane crashes make big news, particularly when, say, it's a plane with John Kennedy Jr. on it. Are small planes more dangerous than the large ones?
They certainly are. And that can be the question that NASA, a government agency, has been working on for 20 years, is how exactly they can address this. I think there's one area in which the general impression of small planes is different from the operating reality of them. The general impression is essentially they fall out of the sky at random, and anybody famous gets in one, it's going to crash. And while they are statistically about 10 times more dangerous than airliners, since there are some years when there are no airline fatalities, the reasons are not random but very predictable. They involve mainly getting into bad weather or pilots who lose their orientation, as was apparently the case with John Kennedy. So the main way this is correctable is with a different kind of engine, with jet engines, small jet engines now in development that let pilots fly around bad weather high enough to be out of certain kinds of icing and other conditions, and also with very, very advanced yet paradoxically simple computer guidance systems essentially are like the Macintosh. The more modern the plane, the easier it is to fly because you have a better sort of Macintosh-like picture of what you're doing, where you're going, where you are. So small planes are more dangerous now, but there's serious work on making them as safe as airlines.
One of the small plane prototypes has a full plane parachute. Would you describe what that does?
Yes. This is the so-called Cirrus SR-20, made by the Cirrus company of Duluth, Minnesota. And it has one of the founders of this company, a man named Alan Klapmeyer, who's been a pilot all his life, like almost everybody else who's designing these new things. He's now 40 or 41. When he was in his early 20s, he almost died in a mid-air collision. He was doing some training flight in the Midwest. Another plane hit his, and the other pilot was killed, and Alan Klapmeyer was able just barely to guide his damaged plane in for a safe landing. He had always wanted to build airplanes for a career. Now, some people with that experience might conclude, well, no more airplanes for me. What he concluded was he wanted to make the safest airplane ever. And over the last 15 years, he and his brother and their company, now with several hundred employees, produced a plane with a parachute for the whole plane. If you get into trouble, you're in a John Kennedy situation, you're spiraling to the ground, the wing falls off, you name it, you pull the parachute. And the parachute drops the whole plane to the ground in a way that breaks the wheels off the plane but doesn't hurt you and doesn't hurt people on the ground it might hit.
Has that been tested? Does it work?
It's been tested very, very extensively, in test. There are now, I think, 180 of these planes in the field. They first were certified about 2 years ago. They're being produced about one a day now. Nobody's had to use one in practice yet. Nobody's actually been the first one to pull the chute. But they did test them, and I have actually the cover of my book is a picture of one of these tests with a bright blue parachute and the white plane sort of drifting down in a cute aspect.
My guest is James Fallows. His new book is called Free Flight, From Airline Hell to a New Age of Travel. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is James Fallows. He's the author of the new book, Free Flight, From Airline Hell to a New Age of Travel. The system that you're interested in, this system with small jets going to small airports, how would that affect air traffic control? Because if the system went into effect, there'd be a lot more planes in the sky.
There would be more planes in the sky, but something that is really hard to believe unless you've experienced it is how few planes there are in the sky except right around a big airport. I've for the last couple of years, I've been flying little planes, and I enjoy doing it. And there are times, hours and hours can pass without seeing another plane. Around big airports, it's different. And the approach, to come here actually to talk with you today was flying past Los Angeles International Airport, and there are planes by the zillion lined up to land there, and so too around San Francisco, et cetera. But in most little airports, there basically isn't much traffic at all. The big sky theory, as it's called in aviation, is extremely impressive when you see it. On the air traffic control, one of the things which NASA and the FAA are jointly working on is better computer systems, so it wouldn't be this matter of the controller like on a CB radio saying, United 281, turn right 5 degrees for traffic. But instead you'd have each plane sort of sensing and transmitting all the time where it was, where the other traffic was, how it could sort of minutely adjust its course to avoid everybody else. So this seems like a solvable problem. Much harder problems are solved with technology, like routing phone calls across the phone network and routing internet traffic.
You've been looking at new small jet models made by two different companies. Tell us a little bit about the models that are in the works now.
There's a plane, the plane that is most expected to first demonstrate the potential of this smaller taxi system is one called the Eclipse 500, which comes from a very strange sort of corporate background. Its founders are two people. One is a man named Vern Rayburn, who's a veteran of the software business. He's in his early 50s now. He was a very early employee at Microsoft and Symantec, Lotus, the other places. He made some money in software and was, but had always been a lifelong aviation nut and was looking for some way to get into the aviation business. The other is a man named Sam Williams, who's now in his early 80s, and a man who has spent his entire life building turbine engines, that is, little jet engines. And he tried to make a turbine-powered car that didn't quite work. He made one of the personal jetpacks, like in the James Bond movies, which he actually sold to the military. These proved to be not so practical for actual use because what happened if they failed? You had some poor personal jetpack guy 500 feet in the sky. who was falling. But he did succeed brilliantly in building for the cruise missile program of the military a very light, very efficient, very reliable engine that made these cruise missiles possible. So Sam Williams and Vern Rayburn about 3 years ago said, it's time to make a small jet. With these magic little light engines we've made, that Sam Williams had made, we can make a jet that is radically cheaper than anything that now exists. And from that, many things will follow. So the Eclipse 500, which is expected to fly in prototype early next year, would cost about one-fifth as much as any comparable corporate jet. It would hold five or six people. It would go, you know, as high as an airliner. It would go effectively as fast as an airliner when you get rid of the sort of hub-and-spoke routing. But it would be priced, you know, at under $1 million. Now, under $1 million, I'm still not going to buy it myself, and neither are you. But with that, air taxi systems could then offer it for fares comparable to coach fare now. So you could be picked up near your house, go just where you're going at your schedule for something like a coach fare. And that's the first time we'll see this next year.
Well, let's look more at the system. You're comparing this possible plane system to being like a taxi where you call up and you say, I want to go from here to there. So say I wanted to go to a place that nobody else wanted to go to that day. Would I be the only passenger?
Yes. And the imagined pricing of this, the smallest planes you can imagine this working with are indeed some of them that another company, the Cirrus Company of Minnesota, has produced. That they are relatively fast and comfortable propeller planes, not jets. They hold they could hold three passengers plus a paying pilot. So there are ways you could do it quite economically for small runs with one passenger. But with the Eclipse jets, the pricing structure would be that if it were even one passenger, for one passenger, the price might be somewhat more than a coach ticket now. But for two passengers, it would be clearly less than a coach ticket now because it would be like a taxi. It would be, you know, your plane going where you wanted to go. Now, the logistical ramifications of this are interesting. For example, the main thing people are thinking about is rental car fleets, you know, dispersed around the country so that when you get to Boise, you could then get to wherever you're going. So there are various logistical trains that come from this. But the main thing that would exist is a vehicle that could economically take a small number of people, you know, two or three or one, not 200 from in the place they wanted to go.
You mentioned that NASA is involved in trying to create this alternate small jet system. What is NASA contributing?
NASA has been surprisingly, and I'll explain surprisingly, the main driver of this whole wave. It's surprising, number one, because nobody's heard about it. There have been no press articles about this in the 20 years the efforts have been underway. And number two, it's surprising because the airplane culture in general is really right-wing. It's sort of hard to distinguish from the NRA. People are against all government except the part that runs the airports, et cetera, et cetera. And yet, almost everybody in the aviation system recognizes that NASA has really played a crucial role. Their role partly has been simple discovery and research. They've come up with different kinds of wings that make planes safer and less likely to stall. They've sponsored research in new engines and in new guidance systems, et cetera. But what they've done the last 15 years or so is a series of quite shrewd competitive demonstration grants. They will say, for example, we need planes to be five times safer. Small planes need to be five times safer 10 years from now than they are now. We are going to offer this kind of prize for people who can come up with the best innovation, you know, towards that end. And if they come up with it, we'll help support the research for a certain amount of time, you know, but we won't. The company will have to spend for it too. So they've had, in a variety of ways, new engine design, safety features, guidance systems, comfort systems. They've had these sort of competitive prize awards. And most of the companies that are now producing these things say, yeah, without NASA's help in promoting this kind of research and engineering, it wouldn't have happened.
What are the major airlines thinking about the possibility of these air taxis?
I think the major airlines for the moment are so busy with their other complaints that they're not really noticing this. It's the little gnat over on the side. And I think that it's interesting to think about how the airlines might respond. The way in which this might first get their attention is if a lot of their most profitable traffic, that is the business fare travelers, said, okay, enough of this. I'm sick of airline hell. I'm sick of having to pay extra for the red carpet lounge. I just want to go where I'm going, and these little people can do it with less harassment. If their profitable business fare travelers began being sort of siphoned off, you can imagine different responses from the airlines. One is a sort of disinformation campaign, sort of lobbying for controls and restrictions on little competition, saying, oh, this is way unsafe, this is uncontrolled, this isn't good for our nation's transport system. You could alternatively imagine them trying to respond. You could imagine the big airlines going into a flexible charter-type system themselves. It would require a different mentality. They'd have to go into sort of the on-demand mentality rather than the you-go-when-we-say-you-go mentality, but it could happen. You could also imagine them being just sort of outflanked the way some other companies have. And some people deep in this business, including those at NASA, say the analogy here is the old mainframe computer makers when the PC makers first came on the horizon. The mainframe computer makers said, oh, these little toy computers, who will ever bother with them? And eventually they had to, you know, look at things differently. So I will be fascinated to see in which of those paths, down which of those paths the airlines go.
James Fallows is the author of Free Flight, From Airline Hell to a New Age of Travel. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine. His new book, Free Flight, describes an emerging solution to our current airline hell. The alternative revolves around the use of new, small, high-tech jet planes that would operate like air taxis, enabling regular people to fly the way the rich do now. Now, you've been flying small planes yourself. Why why do you want to do that?
I had always had a vague interest in doing this, which I didn't when I was in college. I went out to the local airport and saw, looked into taking lessons, but it never was practical for family reasons and sort of workaday reasons until 4 or 5 years ago. And I just wanted to see what it was like, something I'd always wanted to do. I'd noticed that whenever I came across somebody who knew how to fly airplanes, I was wanting to hear more about it. And I started doing it sort of for occupational therapy reasons. I was in an extremely stressful phase of life when I started taking flying lessons, and it was a way entirely to take my mind off everything else except learning how to land the plane. Things look different from 2 or 3,000 feet above the ground, and it just you never get tired of seeing the way geography, geology, cities, rivers, bays, mountains, things all fit together. And it looks so much different from the way it does in an airliner that it's difficult to convey, partly because you're looking straight ahead. In an airliner, you have this little kind of porthole view. And when you have this great big old glass window and you, the scenery is coming right at you, it is intoxicating.
Have you had any scary moments?
Yes. And in fact, one happened about an hour ago. I was coming to the Santa Monica Airport, a very airport that's 2 miles from the studio here versus LAX. And we were flying in perfectly legally underneath the LAX traffic pattern. And I hit the wake turbulence from some giant airplane. And it was like suddenly was hitting a 10-foot deep pothole. So that was the first time I've hit wake turbulence of that sort. That's really the only scare I've had in now about 500 hours of flying. 500 hours, to put it in perspective, is sort of just past the beginner stage. Usually you have 60 or 70 hours or so when you get a license. So, and people often fly 100 to 150 hours a year. So I'm just crossing the 500-hour threshold.
Were you flying this plane today?
I was indeed. In fact, it was a little Cirrus plane with a parachute. And so my passengers were thinking, well, suppose this this bump had knocked out our pilot. They knew where the parachute was.
Were you thinking, now, what if I get into real trouble on the way to the studio to do an interview about my new book about this new form of travel?
Well, one of my passengers is a genius in marketing. He said, you know, what a promotional coup this would be.
Giving your life to sell the
yes.
book.
Authors will do almost anything.
Now, I know in spite of the fact that you fly planes yourself, that you still, I'm sure, have to travel on the major airlines. When you do have to travel on the major airlines, what are some of your tricks, if you have any, for making the travel a little more comfortable?
I wish I knew them. I mean, actually, here is my only answer, which is something this will be my one Zen-like thought in life, which is to never cut it close in getting to the airport. You know, it is so nerve-wracking to think, will I make it to the rental car place? Will I make it through the line? Will I make it through the terminal, et cetera? If you just build an extra half an hour or 45 minutes, the sort of lifetime accumulated stress reduction is worth whatever you have to miss for that. So that is my message to the traveling public.
Now, the new air taxi system that you're describing, this prototype for a system that doesn't really quite exist yet, Is this pie in the sky? Is this something that sounds great but is never really going to happen? Or do you think there really will be a way for regular people to fly this air taxi system in the near future?
Well, certainly there is a long track record supporting the pie in the sky hypothesis because, you know, for 70 or 80 years, there have been dreams of a plane in every garage, et cetera, et cetera. And so a basically skeptical outlook would be sort of the default mode here of saying, how can this possibly work? And I think there are two reasons to think this is more realistic now than it's ever been before. One is there have been a couple of technological thresholds crossed that made things possible that weren't even 5 years ago. One is something I go into some detail in my book, a new kind of jet engine that suddenly makes cheap jet planes possible. It's an engine that is way, way cheaper and lighter than anything that preceded it. And with this cheap jet engine, in a sense, it's like the semiconductor chip. You go from something that was big and cumbersome to something that's small and reliable. So that is new. The other thing that's new is all kinds of computerized guidance systems, ways for planes to get much better navigational information, much better information on the weather, much better information on where they're going. So computer technology and engine technology are different now from ever before and mean that in a material sense, it's a different game than it was a few years ago. The other thing which makes you think this could happen is that a version of it is happening. Once again, it's the corporate jet, fractional jet model. If you are a person of influence at a big, you know, Fortune 500 company, your company probably has or you may well afford a fractional jet program where a plane will pick you up at a nearby airport and take you just where you want to go on your schedule. So it exists as a concept, and the technology to make it cheaper seems to be in the offing. So I think now, in contrast to the last 50 or 60 years of pie in the sky, it has a good chance of happening.
You're living in Northern California now. Your listeners and readers know you mostly as somebody who's reported from Japan and from Washington. What are you doing in Northern California?
I'm in the see the world stage of my career. When the last of our children went to college a couple of years ago, my wife and I said, well, why should we stay in Washington, D.C. anymore? We can always come back there. So we were in Seattle for about a year and a half. We've been in the San Francisco Bay Area for about a year, doing a variety of sort of tech reporting and seeing the world missions. I'm going to actually go back to Washington fairly soon to be doing more just kind of straight political reporting for the Atlantic Monthly. But it is it's almost as dramatic a foreign posting to be in the tech world of my original home state of California as it is to be in Asia. So it's been fun to have this West Coast jaunt.
Well, James Fallows, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
My pleasure, Terry. Thank you.
Happy travels.
Thanks.
James Fallows is the author of Free Flight, From Airline Hell to a New Age of Travel. He's the national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine. This is Fresh Air.